the 9 to Noon Show with Greg Hughes on Highland Radio.
Hello, good morning to you. 7 minutes past nine, Monday the 9th of October 2023. Good morning to you. You're very welcome along to a brand new week of the 9 to Noon Show. I hope your weekend was okay, obviously. I say that with very much Chrysler and everyone affected by Chrysler in my mind. A very poignant and important day Saturday was, and I just hope, as I say, we talked about in advance how difficult it was going to be for everyone who lost someone or everyone who was affected by it. But hopefully some comfort was derived and strength was found, and people can continue the difficult move forward. I think everyone had Chrysler in their mind at the weekend. Our lines are open for you to get involved in the conversation. Start your own one. 086 60 25000. WhatsApp and text to that number, 086 60 25000, or give us a call on 07491 25000. The email's open for you right now, comments at highlandradio.com. And as always, you can watch the show across our social media channels. I'll tell you more about that a little later on, but starting with the Derry People, Donegal News. Saturday marked the first year anniversary of the Chrysler tragedy, which claimed the lives of 10 people and injured 8 others. Gathering in their hundreds, families, friends and locals met for a special memorial service adjacent to the site of the tragedy. As 10 candles flickered, the reassuring words of parish priest Father John Joe Duffy filled the noiseless village. The last year has been a difficult journey, as one can imagine, a journey of mourning, a journey of healing and a journey of learning to cope, particularly for those that this tragedy took. 10 beautiful souls from those who were injured in body and all of us who were injured in mind on that day, he said. With the journey of recovery still continuing 1 year on, Father Duffy said, the duration of that journey is unknown, unlike most journeys that we set out on in life. In this journey of Chrysler, we know neither the length nor the duration of the road ahead, but we know that we will travel it together. Today, we hold in a particular way most at the forefront of our thoughts and our hearts those that suffered the pain of loneliness and all who are recovering from this tragedy. And as you would expect, it's Father John Joe Duffy just strikes the perfect tone in his words and understanding of what people have endured and are going through. The Derry News this morning. Derry and Strabane had more children admitted to Woodlands Juvenile Justice Centre than any council area in the north last year. The Woodlands Centre in County Down holds young people between the ages of 10 and 17 who have committed offences. Derry and Strabane had the highest number of admissions to the youth jail, with 44, according to official Department of Justice statistics. Belfast was second with 34. On to the national newspapers now, and a lot of coverage of the escalation of the situation, which it's war now in Israel and what has happened over there. Israel formally declared a state of war yesterday as the death toll from Saturday's Hamas cross-border attack rose to more than 700, with more than 2,000 wounded. Israeli government officials confirmed that more than 100 people, civilians and soldiers, were seized by militants and taken to Gaza, including young children and elderly civilians. As the impact of Saturday's surprise attack was followed by a rising death toll, Israel continued its military build-up. Tens of thousands of reserves have received emergency call-up orders, but it will be days before the army is ready to launch a ground incursion into Gaza. And there's a great deal of coverage of this, as you can imagine. But the questions will really be asked of the Israeli government as to how they didn't know it was going to happen, or how their world-leading defence and monitoring and constant activity in the area did not pick this up. It's incredibly complex, and I think you can sort of see in the coverage and commentary on it that people have very differing views on that. We'll talk about that a little later on. Of course, Budget 2024 just around the corner. The Irish Independent continues its coverage. Mortgage interest relief worth more than $1,000 to homeowners, and the introduction of pay-related unemployment payments were at the centre of the coalition budget talks last night. The government leaders, along with Finance Minister Michael McGrath and Public Expenditure Minister Pascal Donoghue, spent last evening in government buildings debating the final elements ahead of tomorrow's announcement. This included drafting a tax relief scheme for mortgage holders who have been hit with waves of interest rate hikes due to record levels of inflation. You might be eligible to that if you're on a variable mortgage or a tracker mortgage. I think those are the two groups that are likely to benefit from that. There'll also be help for mortgage holders who are in receipt of social welfare payments through the Department of Social Protection. There were also high-level talks about introducing pay-related benefits for people who lose their jobs, which could see them paid 60% of their weekly salary or up to €450 a week for 6 months after they become unemployed. Social Protection Minister Heather Humphreys has championed the scheme, which would see graduated payments paid to the unemployed so their income does not drop off a cliff edge once they lose their jobs. Just some of the latest speculation surrounding the budget there. On to the Irish Daily Mail now, and RTE's slow approach to root and branch reform will cost the government key seats, ministers fear. The most recent figures on TV licences show the slump in sales, which has cost the station over €10 million since the Ryan Tubridy payment scandal broke in July, continued through September. The figures show a massive fall off, more than 20,000 in the sale of TV licences, 45,440 in September compared to 66,281 in the same period last year. The overall drop was just under a third and on some weeks was as high as 40%. So Catherine Murphy, Vice Chair of the Public Accounts Committee, warned a very large chunk of RTE's costs are now coming from the state rather than the licence fee, and we should be concerned over the increased level of RTE's direct dependence on the state. And a senior government figure warned the station is acquiring a dangerous addiction to public monies. They are like Dear Michael with the hole in the bucket. The gap can never be filled. And they're concerned then, of course, that it could have an impact then on their election chances. On to the Irish Daily Mirror, and a story I wonder, does it surprise you? Priestless funerals are likely to become commonplace throughout Ireland before the end of the decade as lay-led ceremonies become the norm. That's the stark prediction from the Association of Catholic Priests, which has warned grieving families to expect radical changes at the services. They said that this is an unavoidable unavoidable impact due to declining clergy numbers. Father Roy Donovan, a spokesperson for the group, which had or has 1,000 members, said he believes ceremonies will be led by lay ministers and without funeral masses. He believes they will be firmly established in more populated urban areas across Ireland in as little as a few years. A number of dioceses, including Dublin, have already taken the lead by introducing training programmes for parishioners to ease the burden on overworked priests. So that looks like it is inevitable because the number of priests is falling, and it's quite an older population as well. And we already know, and you know, in local areas to you, priests are stretched across parishes now. So I suppose it's not a great surprise. A record €4.5 million was raised for motor neuron disease last year, partially due to Charlie Bird's climb. The former broadcaster has the debilitating disease, but it hasn't stopped him tackling challenges to help raise awareness and funds. Last year, he and a team of supporters climbed Croagh-Patrick, while others carried out walks around the country. A total of £4.5 million raised last year for MND, which is remarkable, thanks to Charlie's sacrifices, but also the generosity of the Irish public. And lastly, and least, Big Brother's back. I started watching it last night to see if I'd be interested, and then I didn't watch it any longer because I was bored with it after about 10 minutes. But it's returned to television with a barman, makeup artist, butcher and youth worker among the contestants entering the famous house. The influential social experiment, which sees housemates live together in a custom-built home for weeks without access to the outside world, in a bid to win £100,000, has opened its doors for the first time in 5 years. I don't see how it works in modern society, if you know what I mean. The stuff that people are interested in kind of can't happen anymore like they would have in the previous episodes, a series. And I'm not saying they should, don't get me wrong, but it's just very interesting to see how that program, or it's not really that interesting, that's the problem. It potentially could be interesting to see how that program can survive in this modern world. But anyway, did you watch it? Are you interested? Let us know. 086 60 25,000. That's the line for all of your calls and comments. As you know, WhatsApp, you can WhatsApp a voice message to us as well, and you can give us a call on 074 91 25,000. Now, in an unprecedented move, as far as I'm aware anyway, a group of 78 GPs working across our county have written to Health Minister Stephen Donnelly to highlight concerns over patient safety at Letterkenny University Hospital. It calls for urgent action at the emergency department. It calls for the minister and senior officials to launch an external review into the ED at LUH after GPs were left dissatisfied by the proposed scale and ambition of plans laid out by hospital management. GPs said in the letter that some patients are refusing to go to the emergency department and would rather take their chances and stay at home. And unfortunately, that is the experience that we hear as well through these channels. Dr. Padraig McGuinness is a spokesperson for the group, a GP too, of course. Thank you very much for your time this morning, Padraig.
Good morning, Greg.
I mean, when you get a group of GPs like that coming together and wording their views in such a strong manner, things are pretty desperate, I would say.
Absolutely, Greg. I suppose the first thing to say is that this is not about our clinical colleagues, okay? This is not about the great care that they're given our nursing colleagues, our medical colleagues, the rest of the staff who work in the hospital in extreme unsafe conditions, who are treating patients in A&E today who've just come off 12-hour night shifts. This is not about them, okay? This is about trying to get them the help and support that they need and that they require. So it's a really important thing to say that at the outset. I suppose to wind back to why the time is now and why the GPs have come together in what is an incredibly unprecedented move. Greg, back in August time, on a random Tuesday in August, in the evening time, there were 14 ambulances backed up at Letterkenny University Hospital waiting to offload their patients. And as a result, there was no ambulance available for Sligo, Donegal or Leitrim. That's really scary, okay? And that's really scary for us as GPs. If we call an ambulance, that none is going to come and we're left out in the community looking after patients. A huge, huge patient safety issue. And that means if my patient has a heart attack in Fannet or someone breaks a hip in Lenties or a car crash in Inishowen, there was nobody there to come. And I suppose we're hearing every day from our patients over and over and over again that they get great care when they get in the door, but that they're waiting in some cases 24 hours plus to see a clinician in A&E in Letterkenny. Or in the emergency department, and that's just really, really unsafe. And we're no longer willing to accept it. And now is the time when we're going to raise a flag and say we're going to advocate for our patients, and we're going to say it's no longer good enough.
Yeah, and it gets to a point, doesn't it? And we can't live in a society whereby a GP would be less inclined to refer someone to the ED in the fear that it could actually be counterintuitive to their health. Or counterproductive, sorry, to their health. I mean, I'm sure it's happening already, but I mean, we're going to see more of that as outlined in the letter.
Absolutely, Greg. I mean, there's a morbidity and a mortality, so there's a harm and a risk of death of waiting in an A&E department. And so if somebody comes in to me today and they're 80 and they're frail and they have a bad chest infection and really they should be admitted for IV antibiotics, I have to weigh up about the risks of that person standing, you know, or sitting in A&E in a hard chair for hours and hours and then waiting in a trolley maybe for hours to be admitted. I mean, there's a really scary statistic where they did a huge study in the UK of NHS patients, massive millions of patients in the study, and it showed that actually for about every 80 patients who wait more than 5 hours in A&E, by the way, that's all of our patients who wait more than 5 hours in A&E, that there's an excess death within 30 days in that patient cohort. Wow. So this is a big deal. You know, patients waiting in A&E is not just an inconvenience. It's a risk to their health and it's a risk to their life as well. And so we have patients that we're keeping at home that really should be in A&E departments, but we can't because we know that leaving that frail person sitting on a chair for hours and hours and hours has a risk to their health.
And what we see with contact to programs like to this program, and I'm sure it's the same with you, is families might be able to convince someone to go in once. But that's it then. They say, I'm not going back there. I'm not going because of the long wait or they're not happy with the outcome of it. Again, we're seeing more and more at this on this program. And of course, you're a GP. You're going to see it in a far more regular and descriptive fashion from your patients.
I mean, we have this incredible situation where patients are coming in the door and the first thing out of their mouth is, you're not sending me up, doctor. Mm. There's no way I'm doing that. No, I'll take my chance. No, give me an antibiotic. No, do something else. Or, you know, and that's incredible. And, you know, we don't like sending patients to A&E ever, really, you know. And if you look at the statistics of how many patients we actually send to A&E, it's about less than 5%. So you often hear about this, you know, the GPs are sending everybody to A&E. Mm. That's not really the story. And, you know, if you look at all the healthcare contacts last year in the health service, about 33 million of them, 29 million are in GP, right? So we are already seeing 88% of patients in the health service is in general practice. And so we send up less than 5% of patients. And at the minute, we're sending up patients who, yes, are very sick, but we're also sending up patients who we have no alternative pathway. So we're sending up patients to the emergency department that actually don't really need to go to the emergency department, but because of a system that's broken, we have nowhere else to send them. So there's patients who do not need to be admitted to hospital, but cannot wait for a year to get an outpatient appointment for something that's serious. And those patients should be seen in alternative pathways. And when, unfortunately, when we try to raise those issues with the management in LUH, we really did meet a brick wall with them. And we have, you know, it's unprecedented to go to the media with this, but the reason we've done that, Greg, really is because we're not getting any satisfaction from dealing with some of the management locally about getting alternative pathways for patients to the emergency department.
So in layman's terms, what are you calling on the health minister to do? Because you're going right to the top here. I mean, he is the head of the head of the HSC. So as I say, in ways we can understand, what are you calling for from him? When I say you, I mean you and the 77 other GPs.
Yeah, so I suppose the reason we went to the top, Greg, is that we're not getting any answers locally, and we, you know, need a national focus on this if we're going to be treated differently in Donegal. There are three main things. The first thing is that we need an external review. So we need somebody else who's going to come in, cut through the bureaucracy of it all, cut through the excuses, quite frankly, and someone who's going to come in and offer solutions and back that up with the resources that it needs. It's no surprise to anybody that Letterkenny University Hospital is under-resourced in comparison to the rest of the country. The second thing by far is that we need our medical assessment unit open. So that has been open in the past on an ad hoc basis. Sometimes it's open, sometimes it's not. It's not protected. And I want to give an example of this, Greg, because I think this is, you know, this will make it clear to patients. If you come in to me today and you have a query clot in your leg, right? So we think you have a clot in your leg, you have some symptoms of it. I have no choice but to send you to A&E, or to the emergency department. But you're actually very well. You know, you're fine. I can treat you here, but you need an investigation done to confirm with a scan today or tomorrow or the next day whether or not you have a clot. So I have no choice but to send you to the emergency department. You're going to sit there, be triaged after a couple of hours. Then you'll sit there for maybe 24 hours to be seen. Then you may or may not get your scan that day. And our ED colleagues are telling us, the consultants are telling us, that they have to admit patients to get those scans. So the patient has to be admitted, they take up a bed, they take up nursing care as well that they don't need. In loads of other hospitals across the country and across, you know, in Derry, 15 minutes away, that patient would be go by appointment for their scan or go by their appointment, by appointments that I can arrange as a GP to the medical assessment unit to get that scan in the next few days. They're in and out in an hour. The diagnosis is confirmed or not in an hour. And that patient did not take up a bed. They did not clog up A&E. They did not need nursing care. That's an example of 10 or 15 or 20 conditions that easily are managed in medical assessment units across the country. And instead, our medical assessment unit is full of patients. Mm-hmm. So patients who are in trolleys this morning will get admitted to the medical assessment unit, not to have medical assessment, but actually because the beds are needed. And so in other hospitals across the country, not reinventing the wheel, the medical assessment unit works really, really well. Staff, and we have a brilliant consultant there already. He just needs a chance to do the job, and he needs the beds and the ability to do it. That's one thing. The other thing, Greg, is we can't continue to do the same thing and expect a different outcome. I mean, that's just insanity. And when, you know, we have a forum with the hospital management, but we're just really not getting anywhere with it. And for us, we need a task force of GPs, ED consultants, the ambulance service, the community services, community hospitals, where we sit down at this rate now, it needs to be once a week, and find solutions to this working together. And that needs to be chaired by clinicians, actually, not by hospital management. And it needs to have a senior sales representative on that, because the only way of doing that is to cut through some of the bureaucracy and make sure that, you know, if we're like this and we have no beds and patients are waiting for hours in October, God help us for December and January, because we're going to, you know, if we've no beds and no ambulances in August, what's going to be like when flu comes? What's it going to be like when COVID hits? what's it going to be like when RSV hits later in the year? And as GPs, we're really scared. And that's what I would say. We're scared that our patients are going to be sitting on trolleys and suffering for worse outcomes as a result.
I mean, obviously, there are different levels of command and management and what have you. But just to try and drill down to the relationship at the moment, either you as an individual or GPs as a collective, have you lost faith in the management at Letterkenny University Hospital? Now, I'm not asking that question looking for a head in a stick, but it reads like you have, okay? And even to the point whereby you want to be discussing things with clinicians and different types of people that aren't necessarily management. So to be clear, do you have, or do you as a collective have faith in the current management at Letterkenny University Hospital?
Big statement to make, Greg, for sure. I think the best way of putting that is we don't have faith in them to currently fix the crisis in A&E. Okay. So A&E is broken. Not, you know, when all the GPs met in Zoom back in August, that was the word that was continuously said by everyone. It is broken. Okay. The system, if your patients are waiting for 24 hours in A&E to be seen, then that it's broken. And so the management have had lots of opportunities to fix that in reality over the last 5 or 6 or 7 years, and that hasn't happened. So if you ask me if we have confidence in the management team, I'd say we don't have confidence in them to fix this current situation with the emergency department. And that's why we're calling for external help.
Yeah, and this goes all the way to the top. Last time I interviewed Stephen Donnelly, he was like, well, we've increased funding in there by 30 million. And you're probably going to ask, well, where's that money going now, or what's going on? I mean, would you expect him to take this seriously and set up a meeting or a team or whatever it might be and take this as seriously as clearly it is? You know, I don't know how many GPs are in Donegal, but a large, large proportion of them here. And when you actually look down through the names, and I would say most people listening, their GPs' names on this letter, it really is striking. So it can't be ignored, really. Sorry for the convoluted intro there, Porrig. It can't be ignored by senior Sealta management, and particularly, I think, the health minister.
Well, let me be clear and put your patients, or my patients and your listeners on notice that if we're ignored, we're not going to allow that to happen. Okay, so this is the first time, I guess, that the GPs have rolled in such, you know, in such huge numbers. And let me put your listeners on notice that if we're ignored, we're taking these to the streets. Okay, so if we don't get the outcome that we want and that our patients deserve and that our patients need, then we will take to the streets. And I guess to go back to what you're talking about, you know, if you bring sales to management on now or somebody from LUH, they're going to give you a myriad of things that they're doing right. And they're going to give, which is true, you know, with Pathfinder, which is a brilliant program, we have some good innovative things. There's a new building coming for part of the A&E, but, you know, that's not going to help us this winter. You know, excuses are not working here, and excuses are no good to my 80-year-old patient who I send up today, who still will wait for 24 hours to see a doctor in A&E. So I suppose, do I think they're going to do something about it? Greg, we're not going to let them not. And the GPs were really clear on that this is not just a bounce in a letter and see what happens. This is the first step of asking them to sit up and treat us in the same way that the rest of the country. And I just want to give you one, I know people don't want to be bamboozled by stats, but this is an important one. Of all our ambulance services across the country, we have the longest drop-off times, and we already have one of the longest commute times. So the average drop-off time in Letterkenny A&E for emergency department for ambulances is an hour and 30 minutes. For Dublin, that's less than an hour. For Galway, it's 43 minutes. For Ballinasloe, it's less than 50 minutes. So we're doing something wrong in Letterkenny, and we're not getting the resources that we need, and we're no longer willing to be the poor cousin and be left behind.
All right, powerful stuff. Okay, well, I mean, obviously, we'll speak to you as things move on. Hopefully, it's in a positive way. But even if it is a case of organising people, we look forward to speaking to you and see what the story is there. I know you're incredibly busy, like all of your colleagues, so I really appreciate your time this morning, and good morning to you, Porrig. Thank you.
Thanks, Greg.
That's Dr. Porrig McGuinness there, GP and spokesperson for the group. And it's hard to put into context how important this is. As you heard from Porrig there, it's unprecedented. 78 GPs met via Zoom call, and they have sent this very strongly worded letter, which is available on our website, to Stephen Donnelly. It's CC'd Robert Watt, Tony Canavan, Colm Henry. They don't have faith in the current management team to fix the problem that's there at the moment. They wanted effectively a plan put in place whereby it be external people brought in and also proposing things like those weekly meetings, which sound, you know, really quite significant and important. And as you heard from Porrig there, in the clearest possible way, that if the minister doesn't act on this, the GPs will lead the public out into the street on this issue, which is incredibly significant, I think. What's your views? 086 60 25,000, 086 60 25,000, WhatsApps and texts. So give us a call on 07491 25,000. Okay, some of your comments coming in so far this morning. Our public representatives should hang their heads in shame that GPs feel they have to do this. It's a clear failing on their behalf to represent us in Dáil Éireann. At long last, the professionals are speaking up, says a caller. No mention of the large influx of extra citizens to the county into a hospital which couldn't cope as it was. Go down to the ED there and have a look around who's in there. I'm not sure that's really the contributing factor here. This has been ongoing for quite some time. Totally agree, it's time we took to the streets on this issue, says another listener. Another here, while the doctors in Donegal have spoken, the ED in Letterkenny is not fit for purpose, which asks the bigger question, is Letterkenny University Hospital fit for purpose altogether under this management? Time it's changed and heads roll. Another, why when they were building the new ED did they not also include a minor injuries unit, freeing up the ED for major issues? It's crazy. And God love the staff there doing their best, but can they? But they're going to be burnt out by the winter months, says a listener. I don't see the sense of the hospital renovating 6-bed wards to go down to 4-bed wards when they're moving more and more immigrants into the country. You'd think they'd be building extensions onto the hospital. The reason for the government's attitude to everything in Donegal, re the ED, MICA, infrastructure, etc., is the fact they've wrote off Donegal as a Sinn Féin area. Very simple. All right, that's an interesting one. Okay. Right, okay, Dara Lyons is the general manager at Port Salon Golf Club. He joins us on the programme now. Thanks for joining us. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Greg. How are you?
I'm okay. Unfortunately, though, we're waking up on a Monday morning to talk about a very important piece of life-saving equipment disappeared. Do we know when the defib was taken from the site, Dara?
Unfortunately, we don't know exactly, Greg. It will be checked kind of every weekend, so we know it was there last weekend, say, but on last Friday evening it would have been checked again, and we noticed that it was missing from the outside cabinet. So, we don't know exactly what day, but somewhere between Monday and Friday of last week, it's disappeared.
And is the defib has been taken? I don't know how it was stored. Is it stored like with the keypad and all? Was it taken out of that, or was the whole thing taken off the wall, or what's happened, Dara?
No, so it's stored in an outside cabinet, just on the front of our clubhouse. It used to be stored on the inside of the clubhouse, mm-hmm. but we felt, just being in a rural area and been lucky enough to have a defib on site, that we would leave it outside so that it is available for anybody who needs it in the local community as well. So it's not a locked box, but it's a heated, powered box that we invested in about 3 years ago to move it outside. So you kind of don't think it's something that somebody's going to take.
No, you don't. And as you say, you know, God forbid if someone takes ill on the course, but as well, given its location, if someone in the wider community needed access to this, that's why it's there. That's why it's a life-saving piece of equipment.
Absolutely. It's very, very important for us that people in the area, as well as golfers, can get access to it at any time. And we're thankfully, like, we have two defibs on site. We actually have another one on the golf course as well, which is very important. And look, thankfully, the ambulance service in Donegal have kindly given us a replacement over the weekend. We have had a very busy weekend here hosting a tournament. Mm-hmm. And I suppose our biggest fear would have been, you know, if somebody had needed it and we went to the cabinet and it wasn't there, it would have been a real disaster. So thankfully that's been averted, but yeah, still very disappointing to find somebody has taken it.
And how difficult would it be for someone to sort of access this part of the grounds and to take it and drive off or walk off with it, Dara? This is not the type of thing that happens by accident, like.
Yeah, it's not very difficult for somebody to come in and take it, like, because we don't want it to be difficult for them if they need it, you know.
100%.
It's a lit box at night, you know, it's quite obvious, you know, what it is, and, you know, it's there for all to see. You would, you would kind of want somebody to have it if they need it. So it's not difficult to access at all. Somebody could have driven up at any time. We're in the process of going through the cameras. The actual camera, it would be in a blind spot, but you know, we can see 5 feet from the defib. So you know, the footage is with the Gardaí in Milford, and they may be able to find somebody walking away with it. But you know, it's quite a bit of footage to go through at the same time. So look, we are hopeful that we'll.
I do recall us having another incident like this, and as it turned out, it was taken because someone believed it was needed, and then it turned up a day or two later. Is that a possibility?
Well, hopefully that's the case. You know, that's what we're hopeful of, and that's why we put it out on social media. And we're hopeful that that's the case. And if that is the case, then, you know, that's exactly what it's there for. And, you know, somebody in a panic may have needed it, and, you know, that wouldn't be their it wouldn't be top of their list to just let us know, you know, the more important issues to deal with if that's the case, if somebody needed it. So that would be the best outcome, and hopefully that is the case.
But, yeah, but you have you have to cover all bases, and in case there is a criminal element to this, the Gardaí have been informed that CCTV footage is there and will be gone through. So if someone has taken it for the wrong reasons, it's likely that they're going to be identified. So best to come forward now if that is the case, if there's a criminal element to this, I think.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah.
And fair play for having the system in place to check it there on a weekly basis, Dara. Thanks very much for that. I hope it turns up really, really soon. I really do.
Hopefully, Greg.
Okay.
Thanks for your time.
Bye-bye. And as Dara mentioned there, local emergency services have stepped up and replaced it in the meantime. But still, Dara Lyons, general manager there of Port Salon Golf Club. It was noticed missing on Friday, but it may have gone missing in the days leading up to that. So if you know anything about that, obviously contact the Gardaí, the golf club, or give us a call here and we can pass on any information. We are now joined by two guests. Firstly, Patsy Fitzsimmons, head of complaints and investigations with the Decision Support Service. Good morning to you, Patsy. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Joe. Thank you very much for having me. Thank you.
It's great to have you with us. And Helen Rochford Brennan's from Sligo and joins us as well. Good morning, Helen.
Good morning.
Thank you very much. It's our pleasure to have you. Helen, we might start with you, if that's okay. You have dementia now for over 10 years now.
Yes, I have Alzheimer's. For me, I suppose this is really important, and for people, for all people with whatever form of dementia they have, it's important that we have this decision support service, because Patsy, up until now, many people, you know, were under the Lunacy Act. We were back in the Victorian era, so I'm glad to see that is abolished, and I'm also glad to see wards of court, because people with dementia, primarily people with dementia. Honestly, when you hear over and over from families that their loved ones were made wards of court. The main thing is for us that I suppose we were deprived of our liberty and we couldn't make our decisions. Now, I can make my own decisions at the moment with the support of my son. I can make everyday decisions about my life, about my estate, about whatever I need. But that just isn't true for everybody, but I know that I have those supports available to me. So it's about having choices. It's about having choices. You know, I require extra time to make choices. I have to, you know, when I gather information, because Alzheimer's affects my processing and it also affects my short-term memory. So it's important that the decision process, I have to understand, it can really help me and it helps others. And my role as an advocate is to inform people about this and people with dementia, and hope that they understand that this is a great service for them, because it is. It's about our financial decisions, our healthcare decision making, our living arrangements, our legal decision making, and all of that has decision makers there to help us. And we should no longer be afraid. It's important we have those decisions. It's important, Patsy, we have the decisions that we are no longer restrained, either physical or chemical, as many of us have seen in care homes. You know, whilst we still have the capacity to make our own decisions, but we have to bear in mind that capacity will not be forever. And so we know now that the Decision Support Service is there to help us and provide us with decision makers, help us to and support us to get decision makers. And that's, we can have a decision maker, we can have our power of attorney. A power of attorney is something that I did in the early days because my doctor recommended I have a power of attorney. A power of attorney, may I add, is a very painful experience for many people, but it is wonderful to do because you know that then there is somebody there that is going to ensure that all your choices are upheld.
Mm-hmm.
And also one other thing I want to say, that the great thing about this is we can also have an advanced healthcare directive. So who wants to leave their family making decisions about their health? It is unfair of us as people with dementia. So we must take look at having an advanced healthcare directive and putting those plans in place of what we want medically. I always say I don't want people jumping up and down on me to keep me alive. You know, if that's what it is, you know, I think we have to make the decisions, but we need to plan ahead. It's all about planning. It's about using this service now, which is a wonderful service. And believe me, we are so grateful that this is finally rolled out.
Okay. Patsy, so this service is relatively new. So before we talk necessarily about, you know, what's provided through this service, what would have been the situation really prior to someone having the service to engage with?
Thank you. I suppose what would have happened before this is that if a person was deemed to be of unsound mind, they would have been brought into wardship and the Ward of Courts office and the High Court, and their committee would have made decisions for them. So that was that has all been done away with. This new act, the Assisted Decision-Making Capacity Act, was commenced there in April of this year. So the Decision Support Service is just about 5 months in operation. And as Helen says, the various tiers of support that the Act provides allows a person to consider which tier might they need right now, or indeed planning ahead through making an EPA, an enduring power of attorney, and or an advanced healthcare directive. Usually the two go together. The advanced healthcare directive sets out your choices in relation to your medical treatment.
Can you give us some examples of what you can sort of specify and at what stage of the process you might do so?
You can specify any of your decisions that you may want to take in relation to your property and affairs, mm-hmm. such as buying, selling a house, loans, how you manage your money. Perhaps you might have come into a few bob and you're not sure how to manage that. Most of us can manage our money day to day, budget day to day, but perhaps if there's a large amount of money has come our way unusually, how do we invest it? We may identify that we are not able to manage that on our own, and therefore by appointing a legally appointed person that we know and trust, usually in our family or our circle of friends, that they can help us legally to acquire and obtain information and explain it to us in a way that we can understand it. So there's various tiers. They're graduated depending on the level of support that we feel we need. And for planning ahead, then, as I said, you can set out your personal welfare or your property and affairs decisions. And those decisions encompass most decisions that we would encounter in our day-to-day lives. There are a few exemptions under the Act, such as you can't appoint a decision supporter to help you make a will, to decide whether you're going to get married or to adopt a child. There are a few exceptions, but by and large, the Act covers most decisions that we would need support for or may want support for.
Now, of course, we've been speaking to and will again to Helen, who has acquired a condition, but it doesn't, you know, it's if someone is, if someone has an intellectual disability, a mental illness, brain injury, for an example, you know what I mean? It covers lots of different people in lots of different situations.
It does indeed. It covers any person who has or feels that they can acknowledge that they have a shortcoming or identify that they have a shortcoming in their capacity. I remember a neighbour saying to me, I'm getting very forgetful. And that person, she had identified herself, this neighbour, that she needed support in trying to remember things. And I mean, you don't have to set yourself up on this this framework or appoint a legally appointed decision supporter. Helen has mentioned there that she has her son who supports her with her decisions today. But there could come a time where a service like a bank or a credit union or a utility wants to engage with the account holder only. And so in those circumstances, it's very useful. It would be very useful to have a legally appointed decision supporter who can say, I'm this legally appointed supporter and I'm here to help and be in the room and obtain the information that this relevant person, as we call them, this relevant person needs at this particular point in time. Yeah.
And we need the organisations and that you mentioned and others similar to have a systems in place to recognise that as well and to make that process as streamlined as is possible. So a diagnosis is not required, but it's like you declare you have something or must you? Or how does that work?
No, a diagnosis necessarily is not required. I mean, anybody can seek a support depending on how they feel themselves. So if the lowest tier, the decision-making assistant, is the person that will help gather up information for you and explain it to you in a way that you can understand. Sometimes schemes and different things that we're entitled to, for example, benefits, in the nursing home support scheme, for example, they're complicated. And so it may not be, you might identify that you have a difficulty in trying to understand or gather up information. So you could appoint a decision-making assistant to do that for you. And they're legally entitled to contact the various services on your behalf and come back and explain it to you. For the next tier, the co-decision-making agreement is a little bit more complicated. You do need to have a capacity assessment in order to make one of those arrangements. And you can get that done through your medical practitioner or through, there's a number of people that are qualified to do those capacity assessments, healthcare professionals.
Okay.
And then the top tier is where you would go to court and the court would make an order allowing you to...
And all
decisions.
The information is laid out on the website. Finally, Helen, is it... what is it that this brings you? Is it comfort? Is it something that you feel you don't have to worry about? Or what impact does this really have on for you? Helen, you just have to unmute yourself there, if that's okay. No problem.
Sorry, the joys of Alzheimer's. It's about choice. It's about my decisions. It's about my rights. It's about what I want to do. It's about me. In the past, it was always about other people, but now it's about what we want. And other people made decisions for us, and none other than our own families. And we've known that this abuse has been down through the years. And we want to, in that, we want to have our own choices. We want to make our decisions. And we should not be afraid to go out and ask somebody to help us with our affairs if we need somebody to go to a bank or we need someone to go to a post office with us. We should have someone we trust. It does not necessarily mean that it's a family member. It's somebody that we can trust and we implicitly trust.
Okay.
So it's about choices, and it's about making those choices and not leaving a legacy like we did before to our families of having to decide what we want for the rest of our lives.
Okay, Helen, listen, it's been lovely having you on the programme. Thank you very much indeed, Helen. I really do appreciate it.
Thank you.
Take care of yourself. That's Helen Rochford-Brennan. And just finally and briefly, Patsy Fitzsimmons, if people want more information, how do they get it?
Yes, indeed, they can contact us or they can send us an email at queries@decisionsupportservice.ie or they can telephone us on 01-911-9750.
Okay, and we retain that information here for anyone that might want it. Thank you very much indeed. Back with more after the news and obituary notices.